In Syria now, where an area outside Damascus has fallen under heavy bombardment in recent days. Forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad have been intensely bombing a rebel-controlled area outside of the capital. And residents in the area called Eastern Ghouta have endured the worst bombing campaign and the heaviest death count in many years. An estimated 260 people have been killed since Sunday. That's according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. They're a monitoring group based in the UK. And the United Nations has described a humanitarian situation that's spiraling out of control. Anne Barnard is Beirut bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, and she's been reporting on the situation in Eastern Ghouta.
Well, it's been coming on 3 days of an extremely intense bombardment with airstrikes and rockets from the Syrian government side to this besieged rebel-held area in the eastern suburbs of Damascus. And it's been going on, you know, for years like this, but now it's much more intense. We've seen more than 200 people killed in the last 2 days, and the death toll is still rising, with people hiding in their basements if they have them. Medical clinics have been hit. Families just don't really have any way to keep themselves safe. And at the same time, we're seeing mortar barrages going from the rebel-held area into Damascus at a rate that we really haven't seen since I've been covering this war. It's dwarfed by the airstrikes, but it still is causing deaths and fear in Damascus itself.
Now, you mentioned that this is a rebel-held area in eastern Damascus. And who exactly is being targeted there, and why now?
Well, the Syrian government has typically used these tactics against rebel-held areas throughout the war. The most recent one that was at this scale was the fight to take back the eastern section of the city of Aleppo, which had been held by rebels for many years. And the tactic is essentially to bombard civilian areas and infrastructure until there's enough pressure for a surrender. And when this happens in areas that are larger and more populous, like Aleppo, and now in this area east of Damascus, the death toll can be very high.
Now, this same area has been targeted before. It was targeted by Bashar al-Assad's forces years ago when sarin gas was used. Why is this area so contentious, and how have rebels continued to hold it for as long as they have?
The reason it's so important for the government is that this is really adjacent to Damascus. If you can imagine the situation in 2012, the capital was surrounded on three sides by rebel-held areas. And the government has taken back many of those areas over the years with the help of Russia and Iran. And now there's just this large patch to the east from which rebels can still hit downtown Damascus with mortars, as they've been doing today. And it's simply, you know, the last obstacle to the government taking back the whole area around the capital, which would be an extremely important symbolic victory. It's also one of the few major rebel-held areas left in the country. I'm talking about the insurgents who are not part of ISIS, but who sprang from the original uprising against Bashar al-Assad.
So then put this latest attack in eastern Damascus in context of the broader war. One of the last rebel-held areas, certainly around Damascus, and one of the last major areas around the country. Is Assad in the beginning of the end here?
Well, yes and no. Certainly, there doesn't seem to be any major obstacle in the big picture to Assad eventually reasserting control over most of the country. With the help of Russian airstrikes, he's already rolled back many of the areas that had been held by various insurgent groups for a long time. There was also the defeat of ISIS in eastern Syria by a combination of Assad and his allies, as well as the United States and its allies, in a sort of rival set of offenses against ISIS. So now there are only a couple of large areas of the country, this one near Damascus and Idlib province in the north, and some areas along the Jordan border that are still held by rebels. And there doesn't seem to be any sustainable way for them to go on for the long term. But at the same time, the government hasn't been able to just march in on the ground. So they're using this tactic of siege, bombardment, and pressure.
Anne Barnard, Beirut bureau chief for The New York Times. Anne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Alia Malik experienced the start of the Syrian civil war firsthand. Malik is a journalist and a former human rights attorney. She's from the United States, but moved to Syria in 2011, just at the dawn of the Syrian civil war. Last year, Alia Malik published The Home That Was Our Country, a memoir of Syria. It tells the story of her family's history in Syria, as well as the 2 years she spent there when the promise of the Arab Spring quickly gave way to destruction. Alia Malik, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
These attacks in eastern Damascus, yet again, some of the highest death tolls we've seen in 3 years. We've just been talking about it. You write in your book about how civilians experience this war firsthand. What price are they paying here?
Well, they're paying the highest price. Obviously, in the first instance, they're paying with their lives or their safety. They're paying with their security. Many people have been displaced. Half the country has been displaced, whether internally or externally. But I think if we were to talk sort of about the larger costs, if there are any costs higher than those, is that they've sort of come to understand that maybe it wasn't worth it. Maybe these ideals that we champion sort of across nations, across sort of the human experience, that people have a right to have some sort of say in their governance, that they have a right to life in dignity and in freedom. These values, I think we've sort of shown that we don't really believe in them, and that they maybe perhaps were wrong themselves to believe in them and to have taken the risks that it means in Syria to try to actualize those kinds of ideals.
You report on and talk to lots of civilians in writing your book who've been trapped in their homes, trapped mm-hmm. in their towns while the bombardment goes on around them, and still not wanting to leave, wanting to stay in their homes, and being physically trapped and spiritually as well.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think what people don't understand when we talk about people who are willing to take to the sea and take all the risks to become a refugee is that that is rarely sort of a choice that you make, you know, willy-nilly. And it's not necessarily your first choice. Syria is a beautiful place of incredible societies. You know, the people are so kind and wonderful and resilient, and history and civilization and real connection to a place, to sort of know that your roots go back thousands of years in a place. And so one doesn't make that decision lightly. And similarly, it's been several years now of Syrians being cast out into the world, and they've seen how they've been treated as refugees. And so, you know, my family members who decide not to leave say to me things that, like, I'd rather sort of die in my bed than, you know, be a beggar outside. And similarly, to become internally displaced in Syria, and this is something that doesn't get talked about that much, is not really necessarily a life. We think that a lot of the breakdown in society is in terms of sectarian terms, but it's actually much more complicated than that. And part of it is geography. So if I come from a place that, you know, has been held by the opposition or the rebels have come into, if I try to move to Damascus or one of the other cities that's still under regime control, my ID says that, and automatically I'm brought in for extra scrutiny, extra discrimination. Finding housing is difficult. Finding healthcare, finding education for the kids becomes in practice much more difficult when you are a displaced person. So I can understand why people, you know, the choices, it doesn't necessarily seem like it's a ton of, you know, a bunch of wonderful choices. And there's something to be said for not abandoning your home and hoping that something will get better.
It's so hard to put yourself in the place of somebody situated like that, Alia. You know, somebody who doesn't want to leave their town, or in fact can't leave their town. If they're under siege, there's no way they can leave their town. Help me understand how people help each other get by, survive emotionally at a time like this.
You know, I think that's really individual. Obviously, people look to God or to religion, but, you know, one of the things I focus on in my book in Syria, in a place where the state fails you or other systems fail you, there is kind of a network between neighbors. You know, whenever our relatives would come visit from Syria, and, you know, my parents live in suburban Baltimore, you know, and our house is obviously bigger and in many ways nicer than the houses that they came from in Syria. And people just thought it was like, how can you live like this where you don't know your neighbor and, you know, the next house is, you know, not on top of you or below you as they are in the cities in Syria where everyone lives in apartment buildings. And so, you know, we're programmed to be much more a part of our society in terms of where the society is defined by, you know, our neighbors and the people that we see every day and interact with every day. And I think that probably that very strong social fabric in many ways is what has helped people survive, whether it's sharing the food that they have stockpiled or water or electricity in a generator or heating fuel. But it should, you know, this is an utter collapse when we are relying on only these sorts of networks to keep people alive at this point. I mean, this is a failure of the Syrian state completely to protect its people. And instead of defining, you know, itself, you know, the regime clearly defines its interests as the only, as the interests of the Syrian state, as opposed to letting the interests of the people drive the interests of the Syrian state.
Well, Alia, we get so focused in reporting on this war, you know, on the military fronts, who's fighting whom and the factions. Will Assad survive the war? Will he still be standing a year from now? That kind of thing. There will be a future in Syria, regardless, probably with Assad, after years, 7, 8 years of displacement, people forced to live in a conflict zone under bombardment for years. And there will be a future in Syria with a damaged people. What's your fear about what that's going to look like?
I'm not optimistic about that future. I think, well, the things that need to happen, I don't see any sign that they're going to happen, despite the valiant efforts of many groups trying to keep a record of the violence and who's been victimized. But in any sort of post-conflict situation, if there's to be any sort of mending or reconciliation, there has to be accountability for the crimes that have been committed, whether by the regime or the actors opposed to the regime. And there has to be justice for the victims also, whether they were victims of the regime's violence or victims of the opposition's violence. And I don't see anything that says that's going to happen.
Alia Malik, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Alia Malik is author of The Home That Was Our Country, a memoir of Syria.